Today's Teisho will be on Case 78, Bodhisattvas in the Bath. This is Case 78 in the Heikigan Roku, in the Blue Rock Collection. Bodhisattvas in the Bath. Main subject. In ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. At the monk's bath time, following the rules, they had baths. They suddenly experienced realization through the touch of the water. You reverend Zen monks, do you understand their words? We experienced the subtle and clear touch, have attained Buddhahood, and still retain it. You will be able to retain this condition after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. Secho's verse, the enlightened person is master of one single thing, stretches at ease on his bed. If in a dream the ancients said they were enlightened, let them emerge from the scented water and I would spit at them. Thank you for coming here to practice Zen today. I got a letter from somebody who has been practicing at a little bit of a distance. He came here a couple times and basically received sort of introductory instructions, but he lives far from here and is not able to attend regularly. So he wrote me an email some time ago, and he said, "This is really just amazing. I have been practicing just as you say. I've been sitting on the cushion and watching my breath, and I feel so much better." And he wrote me this email where it was rave reviews, basically. And I thought I should just put this on our website, you know, basically. It was just, this has been so wonderful, so transformative. And that was something he wrote to me a while back. So anyway, I got another email from him the day before yesterday, and he said, "Something has gone really wrong with my practice." He said, "I sit down on the cushion and I watch my breath, but instead of being able to be in this very serene state, I find myself overwhelmed by thoughts and nagging anxieties." And he said, "What's going wrong with my practice?" And, you know, I have to say that I wrote him right away, and I explained that this is really not abnormal at all. That nothing's going wrong with his practice. You know, when we first start doing Zen, we do often, not always, but if we stick with it, you know, people who stick with it get a positive experience. You know. People come to sit for the first time or the first couple of times, and when they sit down on the cushion and watch the breath, it's like all of this distraction, all of this anxiety, all of all of this mental clutter is cleared away, and there's like this opening, this spaciousness. And this is a wonderful, wonderful experience. You know, there are people who have come here and had like a deep samadhi experience the second or third time they come to sit. And they will come up and say, "Oh, that was so wonderful. This Zen is so wonderful," you know. Over the years, I have, come to understand that, they're in for a surprise, you know, because after that wonderful opening, often there's this a next stage, another stage, where you become aware of all of this mental distraction, this roaring torrent of thought that goes through your head. This is really an important lesson, you know. We come in, we start doing Zen, we experience this spaciousness, and it can seem really quite wonderful. And then, you know, if we continue to practice, you seem to be back in your distracted mind again, or you're back in your distressed mind. And I overheard two people saying this. One night after the sit, I was cleaning up in here, and somebody, a relatively new person, said to somebody who was a little bit less new, maybe the person had been practicing for about 6 months, he said, "Wow, I feel so great." And the other person said, "Well, it's not going to last." He said, "At first you feel great, and then, you know, it's like, bam, you know, you're in the crap, you know, basically." And I wanted to say something, but I thought, let it go, you know, let it go. But this is my chance to say something about this. When you start doing Zen, and you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath, you do experience a genuine opening, genuine clearing. But, you know, if you continue to practice, your concentration gets deeper, not shallower. And as your concentration gets deeper, you become aware of another layer of your mind, so to speak. If you think about the mind as having layers, you know, if you think about the mind as layered, and I think that's a useful way to think about the mind, you know, the top layer is this layer we call the conscious mind. And it's the mind where the ego lives, the self, at least, is very present at that level. And it's the mind that says, after this morning's sit, I have to stop at the store, I have to get some dog food, I have to get a can of tomato paste, or you're thinking about your cutting the lawn or whatever. So there's this level of the mind which thinks in more or less complete thoughts and so on. And then, you know, when you begin to watch the breath, this clears away. And there's this wonderful clearing, this wonderful opening, and you suddenly feel so alive because you're no longer caught up in this compulsive rationality, you know, this compulsive thinking. And you begin to experience the world around you in a more immediate way because you're not screening it off with thoughts. You know, ordinarily, the world is heavily screened off by our mental processing, you know. So, you know, I myself have been, you know, working on something, I'll be writing something, and I really will have to ask myself, you know, did I have lunch or not? You know, I'm concentrating so hard on something, and I might go outside, go to my car and come back, and I might not even remember that I went to my car because I'm so focused on these ideas, these thoughts. So when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath, there's this beautiful clearing, and it's like an opening up at the level of the sort of the topmost level of the mind. And then, you know, when you continue to practice, when you continue to sit, if you continue to sit, you know, you're going to begin to be aware that there are other levels of your mind, that there's other kinds of processing going on. You know. And then you realize, you know, that there's another level of the mind which is not necessarily rational. It's, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you're at this stage, you encounter the mind as like this torrent of sort of pieces of thoughts, emotions, images, and it's not really sequential, it's more associative, And it's just like this river of thoughts running, this river of pieces of thoughts, memories, little shards of things. And this is really hard work. I told the guy in the email, I said, you know, this is really going to be difficult for you, you know. You're going to encounter this sort of raging torrent of pieces of thoughts and images, and you've got to pull yourself back. It's very laborious, back to the breath. And I said, a lot of practice at this level involves this kind of difficulty. You know? And if you can stay with it, you will, you know, I promised him, and it's true, if you stay with it, you'll get to a deeper level where, you know, basically your mind encounters that stillness and openness again. And it's in a deeper way, you know. But this process, you know, where you start with opening, and then you feel like you're encountering some kind of an obstacle, you know, is very, very common in Zen practice. In fact, this is sort of like the rhythm of practice. The rhythm of practice, you know, we start out our Zen practice often in a kind of distress. Something brings us to the cushion. You know, something's missing in our lives, or we're experiencing a lot of stress or a lot of distress. We're unhappy in some way. And you come to the cushion and, you know, there's this great desire, this powerful desire for, like, deliverance, for liberation. And Buddhism and Zen make the promise, you know, this is a path to liberation. And that there's a kind of a powerful hunger to be free from, you know, in Buddhist terms, it's called free from birth and death. Right? When will I be free from birth and death? These are the lines from a sutra, English translation of a sutra. So, you know, if you think about the psychology of Zen, it involves the experience of unhappiness, and then the promise of some kind of, or the hope for some kind of liberation. And then the experience of some kind of liberation. And then there's a moment where that liberation is replaced by something which feels like a reversal of fortune, or going backward, or being back in your old distress again. So let me just take you through that again. You know, people start out with a kind of condition of emotional distress or unhappiness. They begin to do zazen, they begin to feel better, then there's this experience, and there's this wonderful feeling like I'm finally free from birth and death, right? And then there's this experience of, wait, you know, I'm back in my distress again. You know? This is really quite common, and in fact, this is sort of like the rhythm of practice, the rhythm of practice. It's not the way we normally think about how we're going to progress in our Zen life. You know, so the first time you have a breakthrough in Zen, you might think, oh, this feels so wonderful. You know, this path of Zen is going to be so great because I'm going to go from one blissful moment to the next. See? From now on, bliss. This sounds so wonderful. I was in so... And it's true, you know, many people... I myself came to Zen because I was in a lot of unhappiness. I was in a lot of distress. And the first time I entered deep samadhi and experienced this openness, I thought I had been saved, you know. And it was, but not in quite the way I thought. Because, you know, this openness was followed by... another feeling of being stuck again, or being trapped again, or being enclosed again, you know? This is part of the rhythm of practice, and it's a little difficult to deal with, because we don't expect this, especially if we've been practicing for a long time, but even beginners have a hard time with this, you know? Those two people talking after a Monday night sit or a Friday night sit, you know, it was, you know, the one guy warned the other and said, yeah, at first it feels great, and then then comes the, you know, you're back in the crap, you know, this idea. This is not what people expect. They expect bliss, bliss, bliss. You know, it's like ascending stages of joy or ascending stages of happiness. And yet, you know, that's not a realistic picture of anything, right? When I moved to Seattle with my wife, Barbara, I didn't know what to expect. And I fell in love with Seattle. So many good things happened to me in Seattle. I went to graduate school. I learned that I started teaching, which has been a lifelong passion of mine. I learned a lot of new ideas. I lived in this fascinating city where, you know, full of artists and very creative people and very multicultural so on and so on. You know, going to Seattle was just this wonderful experience. And I had been there earlier in my life when my father was stationed at a naval base nearby, but I had never really experienced Seattle. You know. So you know, when I went to Seattle with my wife and we lived there and I was going to graduate school, I was like, this whole life opened up to me, and it was so wonderful, you know. Anyway, after I finished my PhD, I had to find a job, and I got this job at Rutgers. And coming to Rutgers was so hard for me, you know, because I loved Seattle. I had all my friends. It was this wonderful experience. And then coming here was so difficult, you know. So difficult. I could have stayed in Seattle. You know, I really could have stayed in Seattle, and maybe I would have been happy. I don't know. A friend of mine, I went to graduate school with a guy named Brad. I won't give you his last name. But Brad and I started graduate school together, and he he didn't finish his PhD. Went through his qualifying exams, and then he decided, I don't want to leave Seattle. So he actually got a job as a bus driver in Seattle. And as far as I know, he's been driving buses all his life in Seattle. He wanted to stay in Seattle. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know. I mean, I wanted to stay too. I'm glad I didn't drive a bus because I'm a terrible driver. I made the decision to come out to New Jersey, and it was very difficult. You know, I had to struggle with all the same things that I had struggled with before in my life, you know. When I was younger, I was, isolation, not knowing what to, you know, where things were, trying to adjust to a very different culture from the culture of Seattle, you know. I learned a lot from coming to New Jersey. I grew as a human being, but it wasn't necessarily an entirely pleasant experience. I'm not criticizing my friend Brad for staying in Seattle, but when I came here, it was hard, it was difficult, and yet, you know, I think I came out on the other end of my New Jersey experience, you know, with a bigger mind, a bigger mind. I hope this is making some sense. And other things are like this too, you know. When I was in graduate school, I would write papers and I would get pretty good grades on my papers. But writing a book was much harder than that, you know. And when I had to actually write a book, it was so difficult. It was the hardest thing I had ever done. And I remember I actually the last summer I was working on this book before my leave ended. I would get up every day, do zazen, write until noon, go for a jog, have lunch, and then keep writing until the end of the evening. And then I would get up again and do it the next day. My legs and back just killed me from sitting in that chair day after day. And I think I was really in a lot of psychological distress from trying to assimilate all this information and write all this stuff. And I was under so much pressure to do this too, because if you don't publish, you basically get fired, you know. And yet, you know, after it was over, I was so glad I did it, even though it was hard, because I felt, it was like my world became bigger, you know? Many things are like this. When you get married, you know, you think it's going to be, the first time you go out on a date with somebody you really hit it off with, you know, you think, oh my God, life is going to be so beautiful with this person, right? And you have fantasies, basically, of like one wonderful date, that your first date went beautifully, you went out to a show, you walked through the trees, it was spring, you think every day is going to be like this. You know, you may not think it consciously, but unconsciously. It's like there's this desire. You know, when you get into any kind of a relationship, it gets tough. It's difficult and challenging. And there's times where it's just so hard, because you're learning about yourself, you're learning about the other person, you're encountering your limits. You know, if you find somebody you want to live with, it can be challenging. But then, you know, on the other side of it, you realize my life is bigger, my world is bigger. Well, you know, Zen practice is like this too, right? You know, Zen practice is like this too. It's not bliss, 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 bliss. It involves moments where you feel like you're back in the crap, because your world is getting bigger, because your world is getting bigger. And so, you know, when you start sitting, you're in a lot of distress, and you watch your breath, and you learn how to focus your mind one-pointedly. You learn how not to be, not to think, but how to focus your attention on the present moment and dwell in the present moment. And if you just do that for a few seconds, you feel wonderful. You feel blissful. You know, but then, if you keep practicing, you find yourself in a distressing situation where your mind, you're encountering all of these fragments of thoughts and these distractions and so on. And you can feel very disappointed. You can feel like, well, my practice, I'm going backward. Or, you know, I remember there's a koan that actually deals with this in the Mumonkan, this whole process. And this is one that deals with it in a rather different way. But I was working on this koan, and I would go into deep mushin. Everything would disappear, and then I would be back in on the cushion with my problems. And basically, when I found myself back on the cushion with my problems, I was so mad, I became furious. And I remember actually leaving a session thinking, this Zen is just a bunch of crap, you know. I'm going to quit. This is a scam. This is a fraud, you know. What had happened to me was that, you know, my process of my practice was leading me to a deeper encounter with my fears and my obstacles. So, you know, Zen practice is like a, you know, basically process of opening up. But after each opening, you know, the next stage is to encounter your obstacles again in a new and deeper way. I hope this makes some sense, you know. It's like, you know, this is like a process, a gradual process of refining and liberating. But it's not linear. It doesn't go bliss, 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 bliss. It goes bliss, crap, bliss, crap, bliss, crap, see. It's like that. And when you fall off your pedestal, when you fall off your beautiful place, and you're back in these complexities, and you're back in these difficulties, it can be very distressing. You can feel like you're back at square one, and in a certain way you are. But your world can't get bigger unless you confront your fears and your obstacles. And so, you know, there's a rhythm to practice which people don't always understand. And it involves experiencing this beautiful openness, and then you have to come back to your problems and engage with them more deeply. And this can create a lot of, actually can create a lot of anger. For me, I remember one session being absolutely livid, because I didn't think I was ever going to have to deal with my problems, my fears, and my obstacles again. And yet there they were, right there, staring me in the face on the cushion. And any teacher worth his salt is going to help you to encounter your obstacles. You know, there is a little bit of salesmanship in Zen and in Buddhism generally, you know. So, you know, when they, on the back of most Buddhist books, you know, there's often a picture of the teacher, and he's usually laughing, very smiley, you know. And naturally, when people come to sit for the first time, if you say, this is going to be a rough road, you know, they might not come back, right? It's funny, if you read the Mumonkan, you know, however, if you read the Mumonkan, right at the front of the Mumonkan, Master Mumon says, you have to climb up a mountain of swords. And he said, and the road is littered with skulls, right? Think about that. Now, that's truth in advertising, right? You know? Wow! Welcome to Zen! Of course, I think that Zen attracts a kind of person who isn't frightened of that. See, I think there's a Zen temperament. I really do. There's a Zen personality. There's a kind of person who says, mountain of skulls, thanks but no thanks, right? And there's a person who says, that sounds interesting, right? And if you say, that sounds interesting, then, you know, you're in the right place. But there is in Zen and in Buddhism generally a kind of advertising, you know, where, you know, basically everybody's, you know, every time I have to say, I read the newspaper every day after sitting. I go online and I read the paper, and I always Google Buddhism to see what's going on. And there's usually some article, you know, happiest man in the world, and it's a Zen monk or a Tibetan monk, you know, and they interview him. How did you get so happy, you know? And of course, happiness is the goal. In many Buddhist ceremonies, people, it ends by saying, may all beings be happy, you know. So happiness is the goal. But, you know, you can't be happy if you're basically not encountering reality, right? And reality's hard to encounter because we're afraid. It can be challenging. It can be difficult. You know, there's a stage in Zen practice called, it's when you can begin to get into samadhi, deep samadhi. This usually happens to people, you know. Around 2 or 3 years into your practice, you may be able to get into very deep samadhi. And it's very beautiful. It's very blissful and nice. And, you know, usually people are working with the breath perception, and they get into this samadhi where everything is very beautiful, very nice, very sweet. And that is called the cave of poison grass. Because it's like you're going to go into the cave and just eat the grass, you know. And you'll never get out. This is why samadhi is not enlightenment, right? When you can get into deep samadhi, you have to be able to do it, but it's not enlightenment. And there are many, you know, people often quit doing Zen once they can get into samadhi, because they think this is enlightenment. And indeed, in some religious traditions, in some meditation traditions, not Buddhist traditions, but in some, samadhi is thought to be enlightenment. That's thought to be the presence of God, and so on. But in Buddhism, the answer is no. You know, Buddha encountered samadhi and said, this is not enlightenment. And it's not enlightenment because it's not really, you know, you can get to this place where you are very blissful and very happy, but you're not dealing with your stuff. This was only recently. Now, everybody who practices Zen actually is guilty of doing this to some degree. It's a powerful temptation not to deal with our obstacles and to just stay in this blissful place. Recently, a number of practitioners who are also psychotherapists have been dealing with this problem. And this has actually entered the writing on American Buddhism. You know, there have been a number of these Zen teachers who have been involved in scandals. And people have asked, you know, how is it possible that these people who have been practicing meditation for 30 years have been involved in these scandals? And, you know, some of these people very clearly are not healthy psychologically. And you think, how's that possible? But if you become addicted to blissful samadhi, you know, and you don't deal with your obstacles, the phrase for this now is called spiritual bypassing. I actually love that phrase. I mean, I've done it myself many times. You know, once you recognize it, you can see yourself doing it. It's where you can get, instead of, you know, dealing with your problems, you know, you're just in this, you just sort of go into this blissful state and dwell there. And so, you know, one of the functions of a good teacher and a good practice is that you deal with your stuff on the cushion. You need to get into samadhi. You need to be in that empty, stable mind. But then you have to deal with your problems. And if you're that's difficult to do. And when it happens, you can feel, once again, disappointed, or as though your practice has gotten you nowhere, right? This is hard to do because people invest so much time and energy in practice, and then they find yet another level of obstacles, right? Yet another level of obstacles. This is the real rhythm of practice, right? Starting in distress, encountering openness, and then finding yourself in distress again. And at that moment, you can be hopping mad. You can be heartbroken. You can be disappointed. You can quit, basically. You can say, enough of this. And some people never get to this stage because they just want to stay. They want to linger in a nice samadhi. If you're training, really seriously training, you will encounter your obstacles once again. You know, if you just keep sitting, there they are. And I was so happy when I received that letter, that email from that person, because he was telling me something so important. You know, he said, I was in this wonderful, wonderful month of sitting, and now I'm my mind is a wreck again, and I'm pulled and pushed, and I have conflicting emotions, and da-da-da. And it's like, oh, I'm so glad this happened to you. Because now it's back to work. Right, back to work, and we watch the breath, we enter samadhi, and then we begin to be in a position to sort of work it through. So, you know, if somebody has, somebody in your life let you down, you know, when you were a kid. And maybe you repeat that behavior all your life. You know, you're always a little distrustful. You're always expecting people to let you down. You know, maybe in some relationship recently, you had some very unpleasant experience with somebody, and you're in a lot of distress. That could happen, right? And you come in and you sit down on the cushion. And you start watching your breath, and you could just get to a place where you're feeling, you're not feeling any pain anymore, right? You're not feeling pain. And you could just stay there, you know, and not deal with this. It's like there's something, there's an elephant in the room, but you're not going to deal with your recent blow-up with somebody. You're just going to sit in this bliss. And if you've been practicing for a long time, you could say, well, I'm a very adept Zen practitioner. You know, I don't care. This kind of thing doesn't hurt me, doesn't bother me. If you're a Zen teacher, you can say, well, I'm a Zen teacher. These kinds of things don't bother me. But, you know, that's a lie, right? It clearly bothers you. It's just you're not looking at something that's right next to you. And so as soon as you open that door up, you know, now you're in distress, you're feeling the pain and so on, but you keep coming back to your breath. And at some point, you know, you work it through. You see your obstacles for what they are. And you have all of this emotional conflict and turmoil, but at some point you become smooth and clear, you know, and you feel better. You know, about 6 months ago, I wrote this article that I thought was the best article I have ever written in my life. I'm not kidding. And I gave it to my friends, and they all said, "This is the best article you have ever written in your life." And I sent it to a journal where I've published before, a lot of things, actually, and they turned it down. And the editor said, "This is just a rant." Right? That's what she said. This is just, she wasn't that rude to me because, you know, I see her at conferences and things. But basically what she said was, she said, "The reviewers feel that this is basically a rant or something." So I said, "Thank you very much. You know, I understand, you know. Thank you for considering my submission, blah, blah, blah." And then I was hurt, you know, angry, resentful, etc. You know, and you think, oh my God, am I slipping? Am I losing my grip? You know, and then you think, that, she's an idiot, you know, whatever. You know, you can go through all these different things. And, you know, I can sit down on the cushion and just be in bliss, you know, and say, well, those things don't bother. Those are merely earthly concerns, you know. I, who dwell in, you know, Buddha nature, I don't worry about that, you know. That's a formula for disaster, as a matter of fact, you know. So, indeed, I think these teachers who get caught up in all this stuff have actually made a lifetime habit of not dealing with their stuff. So you know, the Zen is not about entering bliss and transcending the world of form. Emptiness is form, and form is emptiness. It means you have to experience form as form, and then experience form as emptiness, and then experience form as emptiness in a different way. So, the famous saying is, Before I did Zen, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. Then when I started doing Zen, mountains weren't mountains and rivers weren't rivers. And now mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. So you go from form to emptiness back to form. And that process is difficult. So, you know, when I got this rejection, I was really hurt. I was angry. I was, you know, all the different emotions. And, you know, I had to do a lot of sitting. And, you know, eventually I felt clear about it. You know, I actually sent it to another journal and they accepted it right away, right? Which made me feel a lot better. They didn't say it was a rant. I felt like writing the editor of the other journal and saying, well, they liked it, you know. But it'll come out and they'll know that the other journal accepted it. So I feel better, right? But even if I hadn't gotten it back into print, I wouldn't have sent it out again if I hadn't been able to work through my anger and my sense of disappointment and shame and all these other things. So I was able to respond constructively, but it was difficult to deal with all of this emotional stuff, right? Zen, if you think Zen is a matter of bliss, 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 you're going to be disappointed. You probably won't keep practicing. And, you know, I don't know if that guy I wrote will keep practicing or not. You know, I mean, I think many people, myself included, would prefer a practice where you just go from bliss to bliss, right? I mean, we would prefer that kind of a world. And I must say, you know, sometimes in selling these Zen and Buddhism, people tend to emphasize, I mean, as I said, they tend to emphasize the positive, which is, you know, good salesmanship and good psychology. But it's not, it's good salesmanship, it's not good psychology. You know, if you go to a therapist and every time you go, the therapist just says, you're a wonderful person, you know, you have no problems, you're doing great, you're never going to get any better. You know, sooner or later, in a therapeutic situation, the therapist has to say, here's what you don't want to deal with, right? Or here's what here's what you don't want to deal with. And that's usually like a very difficult experience, right? And Zen is like that too. It has a dimension of that, right? Here's what you don't want to deal with. And there's a, you know, the idea that we all suffer to some degree from what might be called Tibetitis. And that's the idea that even though my life is screwed up, there's a place where where things are never screwed up, and I want to get there by sitting on the cushion. And that's not the universe that we know. That's another universe. Right? So Zen practice is not about bliss, bliss, bliss. And you have to be ready sort of emotionally for those moments when you feel let down or you feel you're back in the mess again. You know, that I'm warning you that if you want to wake up, that's the price you have to pay. Sometimes you're going to feel like, well, this is getting me nowhere. Here I am back in X, right? Now, there's another way of looking at all this, however. That's one way of looking at all this. But, you know, our world can't get bigger unless we're willing to be uncomfortable. That's just a fact. But when we're processing, this experience of processing what we reject or what we fear, what we hate, it really requires us to open up and be bigger people, you know. And you know, it's like going from Seattle, where I felt safe. I actually used to feel like Seattle was my city. I felt so comfortable and at home there. Towards the end of my 8 years in Seattle, or nine, whatever it was, 8 years, I just used to think, this is my city. I love this place. You know, this is where I belong. You know, and I felt so good about being there. When I would go downtown, I'd think, this is my downtown. You know, I had this sense of ownership, or this sense of, this is mine, this is me, this is who I am. And when I came to New Jersey, I just didn't have that, right? You know, everybody in Seattle is so hip and so cool. You know, if you've ever seen the show Frasier, a lot of people in Seattle are like that. It's not New Jersey, right? It's not. In Seattle, everybody goes to breakfast in the morning, and there are these cool restaurants, these cool places where people go for breakfast, and they have very cool artists display their work there, and the international cuisine, and all these people go and. Everybody in Seattle, when I was young, used to be like very artsy. So, you know, all the women would have, you know, blue hair, or they'd wear berets, or, it was always wonderful. It was exciting. It was wonderful, you know. And the ceramic, you know, the bowls, the teapot would be some kind of interesting ceramics, and the plate would be an interesting ceramic, and. One restaurant would have this stuff, I think it's called Tico ware. It's this 1940s brightly colored, so everything was Tico ware. Everybody would want to go and eat at the Tico ware restaurant. So then I came to New Jersey, right? And you go to the diner, right? It's a totally different experience. Where's the art? You know, where's the international cuisine? Where's the Tico ware, you know? And everything, it was just such an adjustment. It was so hard. And really, sometimes my wife and I would be sitting around thinking, when are we going to go back? You know, let me out of here. I love New Jersey. I love New Jersey. I love people here. I love New Jersey. I love New York. I think when I go to New York, I think, oh, this is my city. You know. I love New York. I love New Jersey. I feel like New Jersey people are more honest than other people. You know. I mean, I have all these ridiculous ideas. You know. New Jersey people are earth, down to earth people. You know, we don't pretend. You know, we don't have Tico wear. We just have regular old, you know, that kind of thing. We just eat potatoes and eggs. We don't have some fancy food. You know. So, you know, these people are the salt of the earth around here. New Jersey, you know, just New Jersey. You know, we're so down to earth. So, you know, I love New Jersey. I'm totally convinced that my mind is bigger because I came to New Jersey. And I'm totally convinced of this. You know, the things that we don't want to embrace, that we don't want to make part of us, are the things that help us to wake up more deeply. And so, you know, basically this is the Buddhas in the bath, the Bodhisattvas in the bath, right? You know, this... You know, you immerse yourself in this water, in this medium, and you may or may not want to do it, but it's the purifying agent, right? You come out more clean. You come out more clean. You know, the thing that you fear, the thing you don't want to do, when you do it, you come out more clean. Like the bodhisattva emerging from the bath, you know. And you wake up through your contact with the water. Well, water is such a great symbol, isn't it? Because it's uncontrollable, it's got all of these associations, right? I mean, please don't interpret. Let your unconscious mind handle that. But you know, immersing ourselves in the world is the way of Zen. Becoming one with is the way of the Buddha. So you know, you can't be truly awake without encountering things that are difficult and are unpleasant. And that always involves psychologically a feeling of disappointment or of losing control. You think, I've been practicing Zen for 10 years and I still have this problem. Or I've been practicing Zen for 10 years and I still am afraid of this, you know. But, you know, you have to, that's part of the rhythm of practice. Part of the rhythm of practice. Just before you get a bigger mind, you feel like you're losing something. Just before your world becomes bigger, you feel loss and you feel disappointment, anger, whatever, you know. So there's this rhythm of practice where you feel, I'm losing, I'm losing, I'm losing, and then suddenly your world is bigger. And when you immerse yourself in the medium, in the moment, right, and you become one with what is happening, you have a bigger mind. It's easy to say and hard to do. I have a hard time too. There are things that I just hate, right? I mean, you know, things happen to me, and as they're happening, I think, this can't be happening. I don't believe this is happening. This is so unfair, and I don't deserve this, and I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, you know. But then, you sit down on the cushion and you work through your all of these responses, and suddenly you get up and you feel clean and open and bright. And your mind is bright. And this is coming out of the bath. Yes? So, you know, we never stop bathing. It's a fantasy to imagine. Sometimes people do Zen for a while and then they realize that's as far as I want to take it. That happens. So, but it's it's just not the case that you're ever totally clean, right? You know, every day I get up, every morning I get up, and I sit, and then I take a shower, and I love to take a shower. It's wonderful, you know. And I come out, and I'm cleaner, right? Having taken a shower, I don't expect that I'll never have to take a shower again, right? I understand. Same thing with your mind. You know, there is no point. You may not want to do zazen at some point, but there's no point at which you won't have to go through this process, either on the cushion or off of it. Right? Your world can't get bigger without going through this process of, you know, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, and then you either keep the door closed, which is exhausting, or you open the door and then you become what you were afraid of becoming, right? And then the world is a bigger place. So this is really the rhythm of practice. So, you know, it's not exactly walking up a mountain of swords, but it's not bliss, bliss, bliss either. And in a certain sense, you know, he says the road is littered with skulls, and it is littered with skulls. Those are the skulls of all your illusions, you know. So, nobody likes to lose their illusions. Nobody likes to have their dreams go up in smoke, right? But there's no other way to become awake, to be fully awake, fully responsive. You know, easy to say, hard to do. So, my Dharma brother, Genjo, wrote a eulogy for my first teacher, Genki Roshi, and he said something that was so wonderful at the end of it. He said, there's three ways of responding to your problems. One is working through your stuff, the way I've been talking about. Number two is trying to help others. Right? That's, you can help others even if you haven't worked through your stuff, right? And the third way, he said, is spiritual bypassing, which we've talked. And he said, Genki at various times did all three. Right? And I thought that was such a beautiful... I mean, Genjo has quite a good understanding of everything, I would say. And that's such a good account of Genki. It's also a good account of everybody else, right? We all do all three of those from time to time. Hopefully we help others once in a while. Sometimes if we do zazen, we have to work through our stuff, and sometimes we'll just do the spiritual bypassing and wait for another day to deal with our problems. Main subject. In ancient times, there were 16 bodhisattvas. At the monks' bath time, following the rule, they had baths. They suddenly experienced realization through immersion in the water. You reverend Zen students, do you understand their words? Here they are. We experienced the subtle and clear touch, have attained Buddhahood, and still retain it. You will be able to attain this condition after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. In other words, many ups and downs, but keep going. Secho's verse. The enlightened man is a master of a single thing, stretches at ease on his bed. If in a dream the ancients said they were enlightened, let them emerge from the scented water and I would spit at them. So in other words, the process never stops unless your world stops getting bigger. If your world gets bigger, you're going to have to go through the process. Everybody wants a bigger world, yes? So... onward, yeah.